Should the United States send F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine? The debate is front and center in a meeting today at the Pentagon.
The U.S. is not the only one that has people who want F-16s in the hands of Ukrainian forces.
Plus, how Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine goes well beyond the use of conventional warfare.
In Russia's military strategy, this war is a typical hybrid war that includes not only the kinetic use of force, but also, for example, information.
And later in the program, we'll hear about a Mariupol principal whose school was destroyed, but who's now teaching Ukrainian kids remotely from Warsaw, Poland. Today is Wednesday, March 15th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. U.S. defense leaders are meeting today with counterparts from nearly 50 countries to discuss what Ukraine needs in order to fight off Russian aggression. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is hosting the virtual talks, which come as a bipartisan group of lawmakers are pushing him to consider sending F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. I got a preview of what to expect from VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. What do you know about this meeting that's taking place later today?
Well, we know that there has been a renewed push on getting additional weaponry to the Ukrainians, especially ahead of an expected offensive in the spring by the Ukrainian forces. We know that there's been a big back and forth in Bakhmut. There has been complaints from the front lines from Ukrainian soldiers telling reporters that they are short on munitions and they need more. And there is a worry that the training and the new weaponry that has already been approved to go to Ukraine will not get there fast enough. So there are a lot of things in motion right now that the Western forces that are trying to help Ukraine and supply Ukraine will try to discuss today and figure out how they can get the weapons to the Ukrainians even faster and how they can get more weapons and munitions to Ukraine.
I understand that also may include a push by a bipartisan group of lawmakers that want the U.S. to change its position on sending F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. I know the Biden administration has so far pushed back on that idea. It sounds like these lawmakers actually sent a letter to Defense Secretary Austin urging them to reconsider it.
Yes, there has been a big push from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle in the United States to encourage the U.S. to provide F-16s. Let's remember, the U.S. is not the only one that has people who want F-16s in the hands of Ukrainian forces. The Poles have also been pushing very hard for the U.S. to supply the Ukrainians with F-16s several months ago. There was even a hope that the Poles would buy F-16s from the U.S. so they could give more of their jet to the Ukrainians. So this has been an ongoing battle throughout the fight. I do not know what is going to be announced today. The U.S. officials I've been speaking to have been keeping all of the details very close to the chest. But we will see a push, I know, from some countries to provide some sort of additional aircraft to the Ukrainians. Let me tell you why the U.S. has not provided them these weapons so far. So the VOA has spoken to Colin Call. He's the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And according to the Pentagon, they feel like to date, money would be spent best in other weaponry. The U.S. has not been given a lump sum and said, okay, here, take this lump sum, and this is how you give weapons to the Ukrainians. It's been piecemeal. It's been several different iterations of providing them with weapons. And so what the Pentagon has said is, you know, more than F-16s, they really needed air defense. And that is why the U.S. was providing them NASAMs. That is why the U.S. has provided them Patriots. And that is why the U.S. is going to continue to provide them with the munitions in order to supply these air defense systems. So I think that from the U.S. perspective, that's more where they're focused on, even though some of the other nations may be thinking elsewhere towards the F-16s.
Some of the arguments are that it could be a game changer in this war, but we don't know, do we?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. And here's the other worry about providing F-16s. You know, all of the weapons so far that have been provided to Ukraine have a range limit. And that is one of the reasons why the United States so far haven't provided these long-range ATACMS munitions that can reach into Crimea and conduct strikes there. The concern for the U.S. is if they provide them with an F-16 and an F-16 somehow ends up in Russian territory, that could escalate things out of control. And the U.S. wants to make sure that there is no room for escalation, at least on the part of what the U.S. is providing. Whether or not you agree with that is another thing. General Ben Hodges, retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, has told VOA multiple times that he feels that the U.S. Should take the Ukrainians at their word. The Ukrainians have said that they would not bring F-16s or long-range munitions into Russian territory. So far, everything that they've done with the munitions and the weapons that the U.S. has provided them, they've kept their word and they've used them as the U.S. has asked them to. So General Hodges says that there should be no difference here. That is the counterpoint to the concern about F-16s going in Russian territory. So we'll just have to see how this plays out, and we'll have to see what we hear after this meeting concludes.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. The U.S. military brought down one of its own drones on Tuesday after a Russian warplane clipped it over the Black Sea. Associated Press correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
One of the Russian Su-27 aircraft struck the propeller of the MQ-9, causing U.S. forces to have to bring the MQ-9 down in international waters.
Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Pat Ryder says the encounter went on for more than 30 minutes.
Several times before the collision, the Su-27s dumped fuel on and flew in front of the MQ-9 in a reckless and unprofessional manner.
The State Department called it a brazen violation of international law and summoned the Russian ambassador. But Anatoly Antonov told reporters it was too close to territory Russia claims is its own.
Crimea is a part of the Russian Federation. United States does not recognize this status. And of course it's a contradiction, but does it mean that it's necessary to provoke Russian Navy or Russian Air Force?
Adding,
I don't want any confrontation.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Ukrainian troops today defended positions in Bakhmut amid a relentless push by Russian forces to capture a city that's been turned into a wasteland by 7 months of fighting. Both sides claimed successes in what's become the longest-running battle since Russia invaded Ukraine more than a year ago. Russian troops have enveloped the city from three sides, leaving only a narrow corridor leading west. President Volodymyr Zelensky discussed the situation with top military and intelligence officials on Tuesday and all agreed on the need to hold and defend the city. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine is not just with the use of conventional weapons. It's also waging a hybrid war through its campaign of disinformation. I talked about it with Dr. Ivana Stradner, a fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies.
Lots of talk from experts that Russia is not winning this war
on the battlefield.
But what about the information war? Is Russia winning that? Or is it losing that as well?
We have to understand this war from the Kremlin's perspective. And in Russia's military strategy, this war is a typical hybrid war that includes not only the kinetic use of force, but also non-kinetic means, including weaponizing energy and refugees, but also, for example, information. And whether Russia is winning or not, it really depends who you ask, because here in the United States, less than 9% of people actually support Russia, according to the latest statistics. However, what I've noticed elsewhere in Africa, in Latin America, elsewhere in Asia, Russia is doing quite well in the global war of weaponizing information and using malign influence to actually show that the West is responsible for this war and the West is a nefarious actor. And while we can all, for example, laugh about Russian use of biological weapons, this information here in the West, accusing the United States of using, for example, migratory birds or bats of mosquitoes to use biological weapons inside Russia. Elsewhere, this type of disinformation campaign is actually working. I mean, just we have to remember that even Lavrov, who went to Africa for a full information operations campaign to show that the United States is responsible for this war. He accused the United States also of running biolabs in Africa. And the reason for that is because one of the goals was certainly to create chaos inside Africa by weaponizing also food. And then with more refugees, that would cause like more problems inside in Europe. What we see right now that is happening in Moldova and Georgia, that is a typical Russian information operations campaign to distract the West from Ukraine, but also to sow chaos inside Europe. So bearing in mind that it's a very holistic war, I would not be very quick to say that Russia is actually losing the information war. On the contrary, I think Russia is doing quite well.
The State Department has said that some of that disinformation narrative, they're calling it Russophobia, that Russia's presenting itself as the innocent victim here. Is that also working?
So the concept of Russophobia has been around for more than two centuries in Russian strategy, and that is a typical KGB strategy that appeals to moral sentiment in the West to smear anyone who is criticizing Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin. And by appealing and by using weaponizing racism, they know what resonates with the West. Whether it's working or not, again, it depends who you ask, because I think many people in the West have the shame of anything linked to any sort of phobia and any sort of racism. So I would say that it does actually work in many places. Even Lavrov used last April another meeting to actually, again, talk about Russophobia in the West. They use that, you know, also for their imperialistic purposes. But this is, again, you know, nothing new, because they also used, for example, during the Cold War, a very similar strategy where the Soviet Union spread propaganda that the United States was developing ethnic weapons to target Africans, African Americans, and Arabs with US-made HIV virus. Similarly, last past March, Russia's ambassador to the UN brought claims to the UN that the Pentagon was manufacturing ethnic weapons in Ukrainian labs to use as bioweapons against the Slavic ethnicity. So this is really nothing new. Yesterday, I watched actually videos, and I think the UK response was fantastic, because they turned the tables on Moscow's claims of Russophobia, basically claiming that Putin is a Russophobe by destroying the Russian culture and society due to his war in Ukraine. I think that's the best way to do it. They even devoted half the portion of their speech in Russian language. So that's, you know, Russophobia is something that we should talk more about. The best way to counter is through humor and satire. They will continue doing that by appealing to moral sentiments of people in the West, but also elsewhere. And we need to be ready to do that. And the best way really is to use humor and satire to put them on the defensive.
Dr. Ivana Stradner, a fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Sudan has just said it will host Russia's first Navy base in Africa, despite opposition from the West, as soon as the African country completes a transition from military to civilian rule. But while some Sudanese support the business that a base would bring, other local tribal leaders are opposed to a foreign military presence. Henry Wilkins reports from Port Sudan, Sudan.
Port Sudan is Sudan's vital link to the Red Sea, a body of water strategically important for global powers and the countries that surround it, not least for its access to the Suez Canal. Port Sudan made headlines in February after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Sudan. During the visit, the Sudanese junta, which took power in a military coup in 2021, promised Russia a new naval base in the city. But local tribal leaders, who carry a big influence on the Red Sea coast, have other ideas. Mohammed Kara Kubar says he and other local leaders are against the Russian base.
They refuse because they want just to put their hand and stop our port, I think. No investment. They have tribe, they have refused any military in our part.
In February, Middle East Eye, a news website based in London, reported that Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, a powerful Sudanese militia leader, attempted to open military bases along the Red Sea coast, but was prevented by local tribal leaders after they demanded money for development. A small Russian logistics base is reported to have been set up in Port Sudan in the past, but according to local media and residents, it ceased operation in 2021. In the vicinity of the old base, in the Flamingo district of the city, one local declined to give his name when VOA asked if he supported the Russian naval base. He says if a Russian naval base is in Sudanese interests, he wouldn't have a problem with it. I don't care who's involved, whether they're British, Russian or Americans, he added. One analyst said there has been talk of a full-fledged Russian naval base in Port Sudan for years, yet it has never materialized. Cameron Hudson is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington-based think tank.
The case of the missing naval base has been around for many years. This base has been promised to have been built, I don't know how many times now, five or six times.
Another analyst thinks the base could go ahead if Sudan's ruling junta is determined to make it happen. Hala Al-Karib is with the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa.
I don't know. I think it very much depends on the naval base. It's very much depends on the direction that the political process is going to take. You know, so if the regime is actually moving towards consolidating a 100% military power in Sudan.
Sudan already has well-established links with Russia and the Russian paramilitary group Wagner. Sudan's junta is reported to be trading the country's gold in exchange for Russian weapons. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Port Sudan, Sudan.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. The village of Khotyn in the Sumy region of Ukraine was one of the first places Russian forces occupied after they invaded the country on February 24, 2022. Locals remember watching Russian forces and tanks enter the village on their way to Kyiv. Olena Adamenko has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
On February 24, 2022, at 9:35 in the morning, Russian tanks entered the village of Khotyn in the Sumy region.
I woke up in the morning, made my way to the center of Khotyn, and already there are Russian tanks and heavy machinery moving along our streets, heading toward Kyiv.
Mykola Taryanik is chairman of the Khotyn Township Council. 11 out of the 14 villages that make up the township are on Russia's border. VOA spoke with him before the invasion, when things were calm. But today, he says Russian shelling is a way of life.
The village of Kindratyevka was shelled an hour ago. Two direct hits. There was this one old lady. She said she just sat down to eat when there was a hit. She comes into the bedroom and sees that one wall is missing.
Taryanik says there are no military targets in Khotyn. Russian forces are shelling civilian infrastructure.
The schools have been severely damaged, and so has the kindergarten. The hospital was hit directly and has burned down, and we had just finished restoring and renovating it.
Some 100 men from the Khotyn township are fighting on the front lines. To help them, the township allotted about $270,000 in funds. In February 2022, VOA also talked with Sumy resident Andriy Bukin, who had hoped there would be no war, but was ready to fight if the need arose. He has been fighting in the National Guard since then.
In the first days of the war, a huge number of people were evacuating their families, but an equally large number of people took weapons in their hands and have been protecting their motherland ever since. Some here in the Sumy region, some in the Donbass region.
Bukin also tried to evacuate his family when the war started.
We ended up in Ternopil. From there, my family continued farther west, and I turned around and headed back to Kyiv.
There are few here who hold out hope that the war will end soon. Yet, Sumy residents, who were among the first to see Russians invade, are determined to see them leave as well. For Alena Adamenko in the Sumy region, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
There are more than 8 million Ukrainian refugees in Europe, according to the UN.
Natalia Rovinska is one of them. But before the war, she was the principal of one of the best schools in Mariupol. After the Russian army destroyed her school and apartment, she managed to flee to Poland, where she works in a Ukrainian school in Warsaw, and through remote teaching is helping keep Mariupol alive. Lizia Bakalets in Warsaw has her story.
Natalia Rovitska has been living in Warsaw for about a year. She still dreams about her hometown, Mariupol, a southern port city in Ukraine. She was principal of Mariupol School No. 66, a role she maintains remotely from Poland.
I dream of school, where I used to work, my house, my apartment, and my friends. Also, I have dreams about the sea, our Sea of Azov in Mariupol.
Natalia remembers the first day of the war. That day, she thought it was another escalation in the conflict between Ukrainian and Russian-backed forces. Mariupol had been a frontline city between the two sides since 2014. Russia took control of Mariupol in May.
At 5 o'clock in the morning, a neighbor came to me. She woke us up and said, "The war is starting. We are leaving. Come with us." But we stayed.
As the principal of Mariupol School No. 66, she went to see if it had been damaged.
And at 8 in the morning, my husband and I went to school. My deputies came. We cleaned up the school, collected all the equipment, folded everything, and hid documents.
That was the last time Natalia saw the school, the Russian shelling the city.
We stood on the balcony when one of these planes flew and dropped a bomb on the city council building. We saw it directly, and the explosive wave took us from the balcony to the corridor through our bedroom.
Natalia and her husband decided to flee the city. It was a long way through checkpoints to Ukrainian-controlled territory, to the west of the country, and then to Poland. Now in Warsaw, Natalia works as a chemistry teacher at a Ukrainian school. There are more than 1 million war refugees in Poland. Many of them are women and children.
Many children have emotional stress because of the war. These children are vulnerable, especially young ones. When we opened the school, it was quiet during the breaks. Nobody runs or shouts. It was weird for us. Sometime later, the breaks started to look like normal ones. That indicated that the children have adapted and are doing well in the school.
After her working day in Warsaw, Natalia starts online lessons for students back at Mariupol School No. 66. The school reopened several months ago for distance learning.
Currently, 1,100 children study online in our Mariupol school. In total, 7 schools were opened in Mariupol. This is distance learning for those children who are in Ukraine or Europe. As long as our schools are working and our children are studying, our city is alive.
Natalia dreams of returning home to Mariupol. Her apartment is ruined. Her school is among 2,000 in Ukraine that is badly damaged. But once the Russian-occupied city is held by Ukraine again, she holds out hope that everything will be rebuilt. Lysia Bakalets for VOA News, Warsaw.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.